on the last day of this great arts conference. My name is Jerry Fabris. I'm the curator of sound recordings and also more and more general laboratory collections at the Edison National Historic Site in New Jersey, West Orange, New Jersey. The theme for this hour is Record Companies, the Ohio Influence. First talk is going to be presented jointly by two speakers. Patrick Feaster is a graduate student in the Department of Folklore and Ethnomusicology at Indiana University with a focus on early sound recording. His research interests include amateur home recordings and commercial recordings of the early acoustic era. He's currently writing his dissertation on the development of the sound recording as a distinctive, communicative, and expressive form through the year 1908. David Lewis, also known as Uncle Dave, is a native of Cincinnati who's devoted a large part of his life to collecting, studying, and promoting interest in the neglected history of the recording industry in Cincinnati. And Patrick and David are presenting a preliminary assessment of the work of James L. Andum, who was the entrepreneur responsible for promoting the phonograph in late 19th century Ohio.
Dave and I have both had an ongoing interest in James Andum, whose picture, or rather two of them, you can see here on the overhead. A continuing interest over time, his stemming from a general interest in the history of the recording industry in Cincinnati, mine from a general interest in the 19th century recording industry in general. And so when we found out that this year's conference was going to be here in Ohio, we thought this seemed an ideal time to pool together what we'd both found and see what kind of a story would emerge from it. First, we figured that it would be of a certain amount of local interest. We've certainly heard a great deal about aspects of the recording industry located here in Cleveland or in Ohio in general, and this is an even earlier chapter, if you will, in that part of the history. But beyond that, it seems that each time we investigate one of these more local or underrepresented operations, it tends to enhance our understanding of the history of recorded sound in the industry in general, giving us a different perspective on it, different casts of heroes and villains, as, for instance, we heard in Bill Klinger's talk on the first day of the conference. But in this case, it really does give us more than just another perspective. Andum, as we find, is really involved in so many different aspects of recorded sound that really he gives us almost a history of the entire enterprise in miniature, just because he was there from the very beginning and really stayed with it longer than most of his colleagues. So again, this is a preliminary assessment. There's certainly much more to be found on Andum. We have not exhausted it. But it's a narrative that really isn't being told, we find. Most people have not heard of Andum. If you read Reed and Welch's From Tinfoil to Stereo, they include his name as Amden. And because he didn't get along with Edison very well, they don't like him very much. So to begin at the beginning of his life, James Lambert Andum was born at Roxbury, Massachusetts in 1842, the son of William Andum, who died when he was about 12, that is when James was about 12, and Mary Baker Lambert, and he lived in New York City until the age of 18, piecing this together from a few biographies that appeared. In 1860, he traveled abroad, not quite sure what he did or why he went abroad, but he came back to the United States in time to enlist as a private in the Army during the Civil War. He was promoted to first lieutenant and served as an aide-de-camp to Major General Nathaniel Banks. After the war, he moved to Washington, D.C., where he became a stenographer, which was to be very important in his phonographic connections. On January 28, 1868, he married Grace Russell Lombard. Grace was the daughter of a gentleman by the name of Loring Livingston Lombard. who was a veteran of the 1849 California Gold Rush, who had been an entrepreneur in a number of respects. He ran a private international postal service out of California, serving much of the Pacific from 1851 to 54. If you look on the internet, you can find some of the stamps that they issued that sell for, you know, way more than the rarest of the Vogue picture discs. And by the 1880s, he was known as a very prosperous mining agent. Some of Andam's new in-laws from this marriage were to be just as involved in the phonograph industry as he was, so it's worth going into who they were. Grace's brother was Thomas R. Lombard, who at this time was following in his father's footsteps as a mining engineer, a business that took him around the country and into South and Central America. Grace's older sister, Emily Russell Lombard, had married Henry Leeds, a shipping merchant, back in 1859. And had several children, including Harry, William J., Loring Lombard, and Edward F. Leeds, all names that were to resonate through the early years of the industry. James Andam rose in the ranks as a stenographic reporter in the Capitol. In 1882, he served as the official reporter for the Tariff Commission, and at one point he was a clerk for the House Foreign Affairs Committee. In the spring of 1887, a couple of Andam's fellow stenographers, James O. Clefane and Andrew Devine, had formed the American Graphophone Company to market the graphophone as a replacement for manual stenography, something that would have been very interesting for Andam. A number of their stenographic colleagues were equally enthusiastic, the best known of them probably being the court reporter Edward Easton, who later claimed that he'd been familiar with the machine since April of 1887, when it was first brought out, he said, and began its use in business as soon as I could obtain the first instrument. He later went on to organize the Columbia Phonograph Company. But James Andam, too, was drawn to the newfangled gadget. And the following year, he wrote a testimonial. Dave here is going to do the speaking for Mr. Andam. We've decided to dramatize some parts of this presentation.
I have made use of the graphophone in connection with my professional work as a stenographer, more especially in making transcripts from my shorthand notes of the proceedings of committees of the United States Senate during the present session of Congress. By the way, I should mention, these were during the New York Port Authority trials that were occurring at that time. The practical advantages found in the use of the phonograph graphophone are, first, rapidity of dictation. Instead of being compelled to regulate the speed of dictation to the capacity of a typewriter operator, the reporter can dictate to the phonograph graphophone at any rate of speed he chooses, probably three times as fast as to the most expert typewriter operator. The phonograph graphophone cylinders can be distributed among as many typewriter operators as may be found necessary, and the reporter is not limited to the amount of work that one operator can receive from dictation. He is able to take a full day's proceedings and make transcripts rapidly, where formerly he was compelled to obtain the assistance of another stenographer to take a portion of the notes and dictate them to his own typewriter operator. The phonograph graphophone will eventually become a necessity to every stenographer who is desirous of getting out his work rapidly and will increase his capacity of transcribing his notes very greatly.
This is similar to what a lot of people were saying about the phonograph at this time. This was really was drawing the big investors to the machine at this point. So Andam's really fairly typical in that respect. However, his role in this was really fairly significant. In 1887, Andam's brother-in-law, Thomas Lombard, returned to the United States. According to Ray Weil, Lombard had $500,000 from some of his earlier exploits, and was looking to invest it, considering such options as the Butterick Pattern Company and the Mergenthaler Linotype. But that summer or fall, he happened to go visit James and Grace in Washington, D.C., and James took him to see this graphophone. He was impressed. He went on to talk to one of his friends, Jesse Lippincott, who was very impressed and ended up forming the, well, first of all, buying the rights to the marketing of the graphophone and then also to Thomas Edison's phonograph in the United States, forming the North American Phonograph Company. So this whole series of events really dates back to James Andam's initiative in showing this machine to his brother-in-law. If it hadn't been for that, perhaps the development of the North American Phonograph Company would have followed some very different pattern. It's also worth mentioning that Andam's nephews-in-law also were heavily involved. The Leeds brothers that I mentioned earlier, just to mention the extent to which this was a family enterprise, his one of his nephews, Edward, later had an agency in the state of Indiana. Actually, could we go to the map image?
Okay.
One of the brothers was briefly in charge of the musical recording program for North American, and Edward, Henry, and Loring were all involved in the later Leeds and Catlin Record Company, which, through its affiliates Monogram and the Ohio Talking Machine Company, were also connected with Ohio's first disc record company. What you see here is a map of, as nearly as I can reconstruct it, the local territories assigned to people during this early period of the industry. As you can see, the country has been divided up with only a very few gaps remaining. The early entrepreneurs of the industry would each get one of these local territories and then have a monopoly on renting machines and selling supplies in that territory. So Andam's territory was Ohio. He received an exclusive license to lease phonographs and graphophones and market supplies in this state. In December 1888, a reporter for the local Cleveland Leader visited the offices of Hoyt, Ruthrauf, and Wagner in the Wade Building, which was just down the street here. It no longer exists. When he told the man running the elevator where he wanted to go, the response was, "Oh, I thought so. There have been 999 people up there today to see that wonderful machine." At this point, according to George Hoyt, they were essentially helping Andam organize the business, get investors, and so forth. He observed at this point that, quote, "There is considerable rivalry as to which shall be the headquarters of the company." He noticed that things were going on in both Cleveland and Cincinnati. The whole thing, he said, must be closed out before the 15th of the month. This was December 1888. They were showing around a prospectus to potential investors at this point. Here's how it was broken down if you were thinking of investing in the machine in Ohio at this point. They expected to lease 10,000 machines at $20 per year for $200,000. 10 cylinders would be used per machine per day at a profit of 6/10 a cylinder for 300 working days per year, $180,000. Total income, $380,000 a year. Expenses, $55,000 a year. A profit of $325,000 per year. Assured, this is going to be a cinch, as they said in the newspaper in Cincinnati. "Many of our leading businessmen have already become stockholders in the company and regard the future of these machines as opening a wider field for profit than even the telephone and the electric light have afforded."
So tell me, Patrick, how was it that James Andam was going to get 10,000 machines from Edison?
Well, in fact, he wasn't. The machines were not immediately forthcoming. And as is fairly well documented in histories, the dictation phonograph, for a number of reasons, did not quite succeed to the extent that they had hoped. And consequently, Andam, as many of the other people in the industry, began to turn to entertainment uses of the phonograph. There's a number of different contexts in which pre-recorded cylinders were being exhibited to the public in this early period. People often say that it was the coin in the slot machines that were really responsible, although if you examine the dates, that's not quite possible, given that North American was already offering pre-recorded cylinders regularly for sale in May of 1889, and yet we don't really know of any firmly established installations of coin in slot machines until much later that year. So you had a number of different ways that people could hear cylinders in this period. You often had exhibitors appearing in halls much like this one, and they would play some cylinders and frame each one in some elaborate way. Or you had these individual coin in the slot machines that were scattered around a city. And by the late 1890s, you had a practice that I would refer to as, by analogy with bar hopping, as phonograph hopping. There's a nice article from November 1890 in the New York Journal describing a fad of wandering around the city, going from machine to machine. Each hotel would say, have a phonograph, and you'd go and listen to what they had and then move on to the next building. But the Ohio Phonograph Company seems to have introduced a new possibility for exhibiting pre-recorded sound. It's always risky to claim that anything is a first, but after consulting a few people, I don't know of any earlier attempts to do anything like this. Should we move to the picture of the parlor?
Cleveland?
Yeah, Cleveland.
You can keep talking.
Well, the thing is that the next bit is a quotation from Andam, which you have to do.
Oh, that's right.
That's right.
Here we go. Sorry?
He's a number of places in which he described his experience with the first. This is the phonograph parlor in the Cleveland Arcade right down the street here. We went to visit what's there now just recently. It's the place is still there. These are some comments that Andam made about his experiences with that place and a similar place in Cincinnati, which I also have a picture of.
The receipts were at first quite large, but the cost of inspection was very heavy. The cylinders were easily damaged and thrown out of adjustment, and people treated the machines in a pretty rough manner at times. We finally grouped them together in what we call a system of arcades. We have a place in Cincinnati called an arcade, and one in Cleveland of the same sort. We found there that by putting the machines in groups of 10, having an attendant present to make changes and keep the machines in the best adjustment in which they can be kept, the receipts were larger. We had a very great experience in that line, meaning the coin and slot. We were able to get about 30 automatic phonograph cabinets from Automatic Phonograph Exhibition Company, who had made a contract with the North American Phonograph Company to supply them. And on those 30 machines, which we placed in the cities of Cincinnati, Columbus, and Cleveland, Ohio, in 1890, from July 13th to December 31st, 1890, we took out net, after paying commissions, a little over $20,000 in nickels. We also had a parlor in the Emory Arcade at Cincinnati, Ohio, opened, I think, in November 1890, where we placed 12 automatic phonographs, and the first year's receipts from that parlor, from those 12 automatic photographs, amounted to within about $200 of $10,000.
Going to zip ahead because we have much material and so little time. He wasn't only limiting himself to the reproduction of pre-recorded material. The Ohio Company also went in fairly heavily for recording its own. They're probably best known for a series. Shall we go to Mr. Brady?
Yes.
Because of lack of, we have a recording made by this gentleman. I think we're going to skip it. Because you can hear it online at WFMU, if you look at their antique phonograph hour, I would encourage you to listen to it. It's as far as I know, the only publicly accessible recording of the Ohio Phonograph Company available these days in real audio. Here we have Dan Kelly, a retired actor and minstrel, who seems to have begun recording for Ohio at a fairly early point, judging from later accounts, about 1890. Beginning again with Shakespearean recitations and then going on to a series of humorous records, the Pat Brady series, from an 1891 listing of them here, just a few of the titles. Pat Brady on a spree, an important event having taken place in his household, he celebrates it in a noisy way with his friends, with chorus. Number three, Pat Brady in the patrol wagon. Having come home at an unseasonable hour, he becomes demonstrative, quarrels with his landlord, and the patrol wagon takes the party away with chorus. Pat Brady in the police court. He meets a friend on the street, an altercation takes place, and he explains the causes to the judge. And Patty's Wedding, which is the one that's available to listen to at WFMU. Pat Brady tells a funny Irish story about MacGuffin and concludes with an Irish song. Now, the Pat Brady series is not so well known today because people can't listen to very many of these, but at the time it was so immensely popular that when the issue of intellectual property rights in sound recordings was really first discussed by the industry at the convention of local representatives in 1891, it was really the example that was put forward about why people might be concerned about uncontrolled duplication of sound recordings. So if you want to consider it that way, you know, peer-to-peer trading and so forth really starts right here with this gentleman's material. Ironically, of course, you can download the recording from WFMU today. Just to run very quickly through some of the other things that Ohio is known to have recorded. They did also record other recording artists who happened to be passing through. Dan W. Quinn, Bison City Quartet, the Standard Quartet, covered in Tim Brooks's new book. Also, just anecdotally, I've heard of, here's the Bison City Quartet. Anecdotally, I've heard of an Ohio-announced cylinder that appears to have something on it much like Chinese music. Although the people who've heard it have been rather baffled by it. I did find an account in a telephone exhibition where people were playing records over a telephone. One announced, "Cornet solo, the rat charmer of Hamelin, is played by Fred Russell, the Chinese impersonator in the Laboratory of Love and Company, Cincinnati, Ohio." So perhaps Chinese impersonations was another of their odd specialties. Andam really was involved in quite a few other areas too. He published a book called The Practical Guide to the Use of the Edison Phonograph in 1892. It's sort of an update for an earlier handbook that was quickly out of date. He published his own newsletter, the Edison Phonographic News, after the trade journal The Phonogram went defunct in 1893, although he explained in court that he actually got most of it from a clippings bureau and just sort of went through and added comments. He wasn't really collecting anything himself to run in it. Now, Andam is perhaps best known and most talked about in connection with some litigation that he was involved in later on. And I don't want to emphasize that too much because it's not really his most innovative and creative part of his career. However, it is worth going into. In 1894, as you may know, the North American Phonograph Company was thrown into bankruptcy. It became very difficult to obtain supplies in that period, but Andam continued to do so and to struggle by here in Ohio. This arrangement with local companies was no longer really being observed at this point. He began to expand into neighboring territories, such as Indiana and Chicago, although, in fact, those had never been assigned to other companies. Part of Chicago had, but there's a part that hadn't. So he was sort of expanding into areas that had never been assigned to local companies. Later on, what happens is nobody is really respecting the local territories of the companies anymore. Anybody who wants to is now being allowed to set up a company in it or an agency in Ohio. Andam's very annoyed by this because he had paid all this money for a local franchise. And he's eventually blacklisted by Edison. I'm zipping through material here. I'm very sorry we to zip through.
That's all right.
That he was blacklisted in early 1900, could no longer obtain Edison supplies, and was told by the people who were in charge of these decisions that they shouldn't bother to sue because these companies out east were in a much better position to pursue lawsuits, being much closer to New Jersey. So to cut a very, very long story short, he goes and makes an arrangement with the New York Phonograph Company to sort of press their case, saying, you know, you're selling phonographs in New York. We'd bought this exclusive territory way back then. This is not fair. In return for 60% of whatever they can get on the basis of these contracts. Well, it's a very long and bitter fight. So people like Reed and Welch don't like Andam very much. He's not on the side they favored. To let you know how it all came out, though, just a quick article from the New York Times. This is April 11th, 1909. Edison pays $450,000. 700 old cases brought by phonograph company are also settled. Thomas Edison is settled for $450,000, the suit for breach of contract brought against him by the New York Phonograph Company. In addition, his counsel have signed agreements to settle approximately 700 suits brought by the New York Company against dealers in this state. The amount involved in the settlement of these and the principal suit is approximately $2 million. So, presuming that everything worked out as expected, Andam would have wound up a rich man. Retired in 1908, lived after 1915 in New York. His wife, the former Grace Lombard, died in 1912. He lived to the ripe old age of 90 and dying in 1932. I've tried to zip ahead.
Well, this is the Cincinnati Parlor, and I guess that was the attendant, that little short guy that was there. And I have been to all the locations in Cincinnati where the Ohio phonograph places were. We don't have time for the PowerPoint slides, but this is probably the location at 183 Vine Street, which was on the street outside the Emory Arcade.
We're running a few minutes behind, but I think we have time for one or two questions. Kurt?
I just want to ask Patrick and David if they would publish this in the journal so we can get the whole story.
Absolutely. Be happy to. And, yeah. These things are so much easier.
Steve?
Well, it was, to my understanding, that was kind of a decision that was made on a territory-to-territory basis starting, I believe, about 1892 and going into 93 as each company kind of joined in as it became inevitable that these things were going to be sold. But I don't know for Ohio specifically. Yeah, I do have some. I could I can send it to you.
Okay, thanks. We need to move on. Thanks very much, Patrick and David. Really value this research. And I should say we're already putting Patrick's research to very practical use in planning the restoration that we're undergoing at the moment at the Edison Lab.